Rabbi, I turned the AC on because it was stifling. If they're too cold, I can make
no,
it warmer.
No, thanks. I'm glad. It feels much better.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we already recording? I have to press the red button.
No, I just pressed it.
Oh.
Recording. Okay.
Okay.
Nice talk.
Thank you. Hey, good morning. I told a number of people I would explain why I am wearing this aircast, so I could say it one time instead of numerous times, but thank you all for your concern. Good morning. Well, there are many jokes I could make about it, but I won't. I won't blame it on my wife or those people who attacked me after last week's class. I have an ongoing condition with wounds on my feet, and I have a rather persistent one that I left Israel with, and it got a little worse since I got here, so a doctor here immobilized it in this cast, which looks much more dramatic than it needs to be. Thank you. I'd like to briefly review what I said last week in order to lead into this week's lecture. I began with the point that paradigms die hard. It is very, very difficult for people to let go of truths that have been accepted for a very long time, often for centuries and centuries. And when paradigms do change, they change swiftly, as if overnight. We are on the cusp, if not already into, a massive paradigm shift among the Jewish people. But it's important to keep in mind when attempting to identify what the issues are that are problematic with old paradigms, that, as Maimonides points out in the laws of Ta'aniyot, of fast days, unrelenting problems remain the same throughout the generations. Although we tend to think that problems change and that we need to find specific solutions to what I referred to last week as local manifestations of the problems that afflict the Jewish people, Maimonides says that we must recognize that there are underlying problems that are universal and that have nothing to do with the local manifestations of a particular problem. And we need to urgently identify what those underlying issues are. In order to begin the process of identifying some of those issues, which has been an an historic imperative for the Jewish people, and now that I've started, I'm wondering, like, what if anybody else shows up over there? Like,
I can't take one.
What?
I'll take one time.
Well, yeah, that'll be good, because then you'll miss most of the things I say. And I won't have to stay an hour afterwards today. So in order to begin identifying these problems, we need to recognize a number of things which are part of the problems. First of all, context defines everything. Once again, Maimonides points this out based on a verse in the prophet Isaiah, who says, "Mi bikesh zos mi adchem remos chatzeroi." In talking about korbanot, the sacrificial service in the temple, Isaiah says, uses this language: "Who asked you to trample my courtyard?" The obvious question being, what do you mean, who asked you? You asked us. Have you ever heard, God, do you remember Leviticus? You asked us. And the point is, and Maimonides understands that the issue is context based upon Isaiah's choice of the word chatzer, the courtyard. The courtyard is the issue. The courtyard defines the context of a house. And without the courtyard, without seeing the context, you really don't know where you are or what it is that you're doing. The same act in one context may be perfectly appropriate, in another context is completely inappropriate. In one context, an act may have great meaning and significance. In another context, an act may have no meaning whatsoever.
Now I can't stop.
Now why? Oh, yeah. I was talking about last week's football game. And I have to, I realized after the shiur last week, and all joking aside, I do have to thank Dr. Zaghi for pointing this out to me, that, sometimes I say things taking for granted the fact that you understand exactly what I'm saying because I understand exactly what I'm saying. And of course, that's never true. It's never true. Even in common human discourse, it's not true. You say good morning the wrong way. It's, you thought you said good morning, but in fact, the person is offended by the way you said good morning, which is contextual, of course. But last week, I remember saying something like, mitzvah observance is meaningless. Now, of course, I don't mean mitzvah observance. I mean in the wrong context. It doesn't have meaning, which is what Maimonides teaches us in Hilchas Tshuva, as well as in the famous Perush HaMishnayos that I shared with you last week about Rabbi Hananya ben Tradion. Context is all definitive. It will determine whether an act is meaningful or whether an act is not meaningful. And the context, the underlying context of Torah, the most foundational concept in Torah is that it is holistic. It is hadvorim asher ro'u einecha. You do not dare forget the things that your eyes saw. And we spoke last week about the nature and power of sight, how it differs, for example, from the sense of hearing, that it is not sequential and linear, but rather it is holistic. And you see an entire picture at one time. And if a pixel is eliminated from the picture or changed in the picture, it changes the entire picture. And therefore the pasuk says, I didn't mention this pasuk last week, but it's a pasuk we say every Shabbos and Yontif morning, Mishpatei Hashem Emes, the laws of God are truthful when, the pasuk says, Tzodku Yachdov, they are righteous only when taken together, only when it is Yachdov. Holism defines Yashrut, it defines Tmimut, wholeness, completeness, integrity. Without it, you have none of those things. That is the most underlying foundational idea regarding approaching Torah. And this is why, as I pointed out to you last week, even seemingly harmless practices, practices concerning which we say, what could it hurt? As far as Maimonides is concerned, not only does it hurt, but it is destructive of the entirety of Darkei HaEmes, of the paths of truth. One wrong practice will render the entire structure obsolete. And at the end of the shiur last week, I pointed out to you, after giving numerous examples of context, and how context not only defines our practice, but also defines our beliefs, I mentioned that in the last 40 days, Moshe Rabbeinu was on Har Sinai, after the sin of the golden calf, he was on Har Sinai three times for 40-day periods. The last 40-day period was to receive the second Luchot. And I posed a simple question to you. Why did he need to be there for 40 days to receive the second Luchot? The answer is because he needed to completely relearn the Torah. The Torah that he had learned the first 40 days is not the same Torah anymore. It's a completely different Torah. And therefore he had to spend the time learning the Torah of the second Luchot. And indeed, our sages, it's not the time for this discussion now, it's a completely independent shiurim on how the second Luchot differ from the first Luchot, but the differences are stupendously important. The second Luchot provide us with what has become known to us as the Derech Hashem, the way to truth, the path to truth. It is not a statement of truth, as Maimonides points out, but it is a statement, a truthful statement regarding the path to truth. And on that path, it is necessary for us to go through development, what I called last week, childhood. We must go through childhood because creation is self-organizing. And that was the point that I left off with. And what do I mean by that? This is where I'd like to take up today. Okay, so we're going to start. I'm going to tell you, since last week many of you seem to have left your senses of humor at home, I'm going to tell you that I'm about to tell you a joke. Right? It's very important to get your punctuation right. An improperly placed comma can lead to a fatal error. Lynn Truss, the author of a book subtitled The Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation, tells the following story. A panda walks into a cafe. He orders a sandwich, eats it, then draws a gun and proceeds to fire it at the other patrons. "Why?" asks the confused, surviving waiter amidst the carnage as the panda makes its way towards the exit. The panda produces a badly punctuated wildlife manual and tosses it over his shoulder. "Well, I'm a panda," he says. "Look it up." The waiter turns to the relevant entry in the manual and sure enough finds an explanation. It says, "Panda, large black and white bear-like mammal native to China. Eats, shoots, and leaves." So, anyway, that was a good laugh. That was good. You guys brought your A game today. There is a verse in Bereshit in which the placement of a comma makes a life-changing difference. A life-changing difference. And this is source one. I'm going to read it in Hebrew and English. I'm going to punctuate it the way Rashi does. Vayomer Hashem Elokim. This is after the sin of the Eitz Hadat. God says, "Hein ha'adam hayaka achad mimenu." Now that man has become like one of us, l'das tov v'ra, knowing good and bad, v'ata pen yishlach yado, v'lokach gam me'etz ha'chayim v'achal, v'chay le'olam. What if he should stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever? Rashi, as I just read the verse, places a comma after the word mimenu. Hein ha'adam haya ka'achad mimenu. Now that man has become like one of us. As it is translated here, as it is punctuated here. Targum Unculus renders the verse differently. By placing the comma after the word ke'echod. Ka'achad. Take a look. Let's first take a look at Rashi. So you'll see. I'll read the English. Is become like one of us, or like the being who is one, unique amongst us. Lo, he is unique among the terrestrial ones, even as I, God, am unique among the celestial ones. And in what does his uniqueness consist? In knowing good and evil, which is not so in the case of cattle and beasts. So Rashi puts the comma after the word mimenu. Now let's take a look at Targum Unculus, only available in Hebrew. V'amar Hashem Elokim, ha adam, this man, hava yichidi ba'alma, he is unique in the world. Hein ha adam haya ka'achad, comma, man is unique. How? Minei l'meida tav ubish, from him comes the knowledge of good and evil. And therefore, perhaps he'll stretch forth his hand and eat from the tree of life and live forever. Now, this may not sound like an earth-shattering distinction, but Rambam, it's always the Rambam. Yes, it is. Most remarkable Jew who probably, I don't know, can't say ever lived, but close to it. Rambam understands the verse as Targum Unkelus does. And he considers this to be an issue of surpassing importance. In Hilchot Teshuvah, he calls this verse an Ikar Gadol, a great principle. And he calls it, we'll see this quote in a moment, the Amud HaTorah VaHaMitzvah, the pillar of Torah and Mitzvah. Now the basis for understanding the verse, both Rashi's way and his way, is of course the Midrash. That's source 3. Again, just have the Hebrew. Dorash Rabbi Papus, Hein ho'adom ha'yoka achad mimenu, ke'echod mimalochei ha'shoreis. The old man is like one of us. He's like one of the angels. Omar le Rabbi Akiva, Dayoch Papus. Enough. Omar lo, ma tomikayim, hein ho'adom ha'yoka achad mimenu. How do you understand this verse? Behold, man is like one of us. Omar lo, shenosan lo hamokom lifonov shnei durachim. God placed before man two paths, derech hachayim v'derech hamovis, the path to life, the path to death, ubeirar lo derech acheres. And man unfortunately chose the other way, the bad way. Rabbi Akiva teaches a remarkable chidush. Mimenu means that no one can stop man. People mistakenly believe that Rambam merely derives from this verse that man has free will. Rambam is saying ever so much more than that. Let me ask you. This is not rhetorical. I'm actually asking you. Can a person do anything that he wants to do, or can he only choose to do whatever he wants to do? But ultimately, God decides whether to allow his choice to come to fruition. Those are the two options. For example, a person might choose to kill someone, God forbid. But of course, if God does not want him to kill that person, he will prevent it. Which way do you see it? First way or second way?
First way.
Second way. Who said first way? You agree, first way. Anyone else think the first way? I mean, it's a leading question. My poll would be thrown out because I prejudiced the answer that I'm looking for. I have to remember not to do that the next time. I killed it.
You chose to kill it.
Get out. Okay. There's no question, and there was no question in this room either, even though I prejudiced it. Most of you thought it was option number two. Just a handful of people thought it was option number one, and maybe some of those because I prejudiced it. I don't know. But even so, Rambam states in source 4 the following. Hilchot Teshuvah. And I'm going to read this in the English. And this matter is a great and component part, the very pillar of the Torah, as I mentioned to you these terms a moment ago. Ikar Gadol and Amud HaTorah VaHaMitzvah, if you look at the first line in the Hebrew. The very pillar of the Torah and its precepts. Even as it is said, see, I have set before thee this day life and good, death and evil. And it is moreover written, behold, I set before you this day a blessing and curse. This is as if saying, the power is in your hand. And whatever human activity man may be inclined to carry on, he has a free will to elect either good or evil. And because of this very subject, it is said, oh, who would grant that they had such a heart as this to fear me and to keep all my commandments at all times? That is as if saying that the Creator forces not the sons of man and makes no decrees against them that they should do good or evil, but that it is all in their own keeping. Now, the translation, I think, I guess I have to start going over these translations before I print them out because they're pretty awful. But better than nothing. If you look in the Hebrew, I'd like you to just look in the Hebrew for a moment. The end of the second line of the Hebrew. V'chol sheyachpotz ha'odom la'asos mima'asei b'nei ha'odom oseh. Whatever a person wishes to do, he does. He doesn't merely choose to do it. He does it. And this extraordinary chiddush. And right here we have an example of paradigm shifting, because your minds, most people's minds, scream out against this. This cannot be. This cannot be true.
Rabbi, can I just clarify something? If I want to shoot someone, is the Rambam saying that the bullet will always hit the person?
If you aim correctly, yes.
And the person might move, or something might happen, or is there a way for God to prevent a person dying, even though I chose to do
that? What the Rambam is saying is that God doesn't prevent it. He does not.
The result or the action?
He doesn't prevent the action or the result. If you want to do something, you do it.
That's it. You do it.
He might. The result may. You can shoot somebody and hit them in a place that will not kill them. That's possible.
That's not God.
No, that is not God. Let's take a better example. You chew a person, God forbid, chooses to commit suicide. They go up to the top of the Empire State Building and jump off. Is there any way for God to prevent that from him dying at the bottom? No way. God does not mess with gravity. Right? He's fallen off. He's not the roadrunner. He's not. He's fallen off. He's going to splatter on the pavement no matter what he hits. He's dying. He chose to kill himself. He kills himself. God doesn't interfere.
But does this also suggest that there's some logistic baseline that has to be in place? Like if I wanted to kill myself by holding my breath underwater, that's what I want to do. But it would be foolish of me to think that the survival instinct wouldn't make me come up. Has anybody ever done that? Or building the Tower of Babel, they wanted to build it and it didn't happen. So
again, I agree. The result that you intend does not always occur. The point is, though, that it has nothing to do with God. God doesn't interfere. Very hard idea to absorb. I should really stop here.
Rabbi Miller?
Yes.
I would just say that this actually forgives God for all the terrible things that happen in this world. Because otherwise, if God could intervene, there wouldn't have been a Hitler or...
It sure does. You're right.
Anything.
It so sure does.
It takes away the blame from God for what man
did. It sure does. Because this, and Maimonides says, he says in the next source, that this degree of freedom is not a contradiction to God's will, because his will is that man should have this degree of freedom. He says this in Source 5, if you look at the bold section in the English. How is it possible? He says, now do not wonder and ask, how is it possible for man to do what his heart desires and have his entire course of action lodged within himself, seeing that he cannot do aught in the world without the permission of his master and without his will. Even as the verse says, whatsoever the Lord pleased, that hath he done in heaven and in earth, in the seas and all the deeps. No, all that man does is in accordance with his will, with God's will, although our actions are really in our own keeping. For example, even as it is the Creator's will that fire and air shall ascend upward and that water and earth shall ascend downward, or that the sphere shall revolve in a circle, and that other creatures of the universe should likewise follow their respective natural laws as it was his will for them to be, so was it his will that man shall have the free choice of conduct in his own hand, and that all his actions should be lodged within him, and that he should be neither forced or drawn, but he of his own free will and accord, as God endowed him with, he exercises in all that is possible for man to do. And there is a relatively straightforward and simple reason for this. There is no alternative when it comes to the creation of man. This is God's will for man. It is his essence. It is what makes him completely unique. And Rambam cites a simple proof. After eating of the tree of knowledge, God is terrified. We read the verse already. Lest Adam eat of the Eitz HaChayim. That was source one, the very first source we saw. Pen yishlach yado. Wow, I'm terrified that man will stretch forth his hand and eat from the Eitz HaChayim. So we need to move on with history. Now, the obvious question is, if you're terrified, you're God, why not simply prevent him from eating from it? Rambam says that this is the proof that he is correct. Man cannot be stopped once he has chosen to do something, as we saw in Source 4. You are creating yourself. And without this principle, the entire Torah would not stand, as Maimonides says. It is the Amud HaTorah VeHaMitzvah.
I created in the first place and made it accessible. That's why we lock up guns in a house where there's children.
Who invited you?
You did.
I did.
Email to everybody.
I didn't. We don't ask questions when I talk. Now we've gotten out of hand here. I'm never going to finish. Right? You can ask at the end. But if you do, you'll be causing me illness.
We will.
So let's look again at Rambam's words in Source 5. This time, the section that is not bold. Had the decree of God prompted man to be either just or wicked, or had there been a fundamentally inborn something to draw a man to either of the paths, life or death, or to any one branch of knowledge, or to a given tendency of the tendencies, or to particular acts of all actions, as the astrologists maintain by their foolish inventions, how did he charge us by the prophets to do thus and not to do thus? Improve your ways. Do not follow your wickedness. Whereas man from his embryonic state already had a decree of his conduct issue, or his inborn nature draws him toward a given path of conduct from which he cannot deviate. Moreover, what need would there be under such circumstances for the Torah altogether? And by what law and under what system of justice could the wicked be punished or the just rewarded? Shall the judge of the whole earth not exercise justice? What possible advantage could there be in a Torah if you don't understand this? people who are unaware of the fact that they create themselves are also unaware of the fact that they make choices, not mere decisions. Choices and decisions represent entirely different worlds. Choices relate to freedom. Decisions relate to liberty. We often confuse these terms. People often call decisions choices. I catch myself doing it all the time. But functional MRIs reveal that our brains have made the, quote, choice before we are even aware of making the choice. Of course, because these choices are not choices. They are not what we call in Hebrew bichirot, bichira. They are what are known in Lashon HaKodesh as hachraot. Hachra'a means to balance a scale. A decision, a true decision, is an electrochemical or a neuronal process in which a person has a greater desire to do A than B, of which he may be unaware until after the decision has already been made. These kinds of decisions will obviously be affected by promises of reward and punishment. Now, if this is the case, we could say that the meaning of the Torah, and many people do say this, that the meaning of the Torah is to make people good by incentivizing them, to disabuse us of this childish notion. Targum Unkelus and Rambam and Rabbi Akiva in the Midrash cited above insist on placing the comma before the word mimenu. Mimenu lodas tovara. It all comes from you. It all comes from him. A person must choose. A human being must choose. He or she must build their life in terms of something more important than good or evil. Chayim umavus, life and death, are the true stakes. To be or not to be, that is the question. The roots of this utterly remarkable human freedom and of the imperative to create oneself predate the creation of man. Creation's essential nature, I'm going to use some fancy words here, largely because I like to, but I'll translate them just into normal English. But these are the terms that are used by people who study these issues. Creation's essential nature involves heuristic and stochastic processes. Heuristic means trial and error. Stochastic means random. So again, man's essential nature, creation's essential nature, involves trial and error and random processes, such as the process that resulted in the gradual dawning of man's awareness, of man's consciousness. Creation is extended through creativity, which emerges out of trial and error, random variables, exploration, experimentation, and independence of thought. The sages highlight this point in a beautiful story that depicts the Creator rejoicing when one of his creations begins to take independent, unexpected, and creative action. And by the way, this story is highlighted in this marvelous book, which I forgot to even mention last week, called Rising Moon, in case you don't have it yet. You must have it. And today, it's available for the spectacularly low price of
$20.
If you go to Amazon today, right now, you're going to pay $27.50. But because I have a connection to the author, I can offer it for $20. $20. You got a $20 bill in your wallet? Just plunk it there. Okay. Anyway. And if you're if you're really good till the rest till the end here, I'll even sign it. Here's the story. Source 6. Rabbi Chanina bar Papa taught. Here's a verse from Tehillim. And the verse is, if you look at the Hebrew for a second, Yehi chavod Hashem le'olam, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. Well-known pasuk. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. Let the Lord rejoice in His works. Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. This verse was stated by the minister of the world, i.e. the angel charged with overseeing the world. When the Holy One, blessed be He, said, let the earth put forth grass, herb yielding seed, and fruit tree bearing fruit after its kind, the grasses drew an a fortiori inference, a kal vachomer, with regard to themselves. Continue with the English. They reasoned. If the Holy One, blessed be He, wishes the mixing of species, why did He say, after its kind, liminehu, is the word in Hebrew. Why did He say, after its kind, with regard to the trees? And furthermore, let us draw an a fortiori inference. If, with regard to trees, which do not naturally grow mixed, as they are large and distinct from one another, the Holy One, blessed be He, said, after its kind, liminehu, all the more so with regard to us, since grass naturally grows mixed. The irbuvia, the confusion. Immediately, every kind of grass emerged after its kind. As it is stated in the next verse, and the earth brought forth grass, herb-yielding seed, after its kind. Those words, after its kind, did not appear in the verse of the, so to speak, command. They appear in the verse that tells us what actually happened. The minister of the world began to speak and say, "Oh, may the glory of the Lord endure forever. Yismach Hashem b'ma'asov. Let the Lord rejoice in His works, who do for His will, who do His will, even when not explicitly instructed." Amazing, amazing story on so many levels. The implications of this story are far-reaching. The sages identify a moment of divine happiness, a unique event that causes God to rejoice in His own creation. This is the moment when creation first exhibits the capacity for self-organization, self-creation. When the herbage, when the grasses decided to protect their genetic integrity, that is, the information that made them unique, creation was ignited, and the minister of the earth suddenly began to speak, may God rejoice in His creations. God is happy. The only time in all of creation He's happy. Because creation had begun to develop on its own, to make decisions. These decisions imply a process of intuitive change through experimentation. The grass figured out, however that works, not our subject now, the grass figured out how it needed to improve by itself. God did not need to issue detailed instructions. Instead, He speaks to the universe and tells it to produce. Paradigm shift coming. God does not directly create grass or fish or animals, but he tells the earth and the sea to bring them forth. Look at the words in the Torah. This is the reason, by the way, that the phrase Vayara Elokim Ki Tov, God saw that it was good, appears over and over and over in creation. That phrase, God saw that it was good, is an assessment, a response to the unexpected, to something that is suddenly seen by God. One only sees that it was good if the earth and sea are doing the actual creating heuristically through experimentation. Otherwise, it's absurd for the Torah to certify as good that which God commanded. By definition, if God commanded it, it must be good. Once creation begins to respond to problems, to act independently, changes and adaptations can go either way. Some are good, some are not. The good changes are cause for divine happiness. The bad ones lead to a breakdown. Creativity is volatile, and independence can also lead to sin. This is source 7. And God said, let the earth put forth grass. It was taught in the name of Rabbi Natan. Three entered for judgment. Ah, you know something? I highlighted the last two lines because I didn't want to read what I just started reading. And not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's distracting. So go to the bottom two lines in the English. Rabbi Yehuda bar Rabbi Shimon said, because the earth transgressed a commandment, the Holy One, the Holy Blessed One said to her, let the earth put forth grass, etc., etc., just as the... And if you want to go back, if you want to see this, do you see right above source 7, there are two verses from Bereshit. Okay? Take a look at those two verses. Vayomer Elokim, Tadshei ha'oretz deshe esev mazriya zera. Again, you see in this verse, it does not say l'minehu. And then it says, eitz peri oseh peri l'mina. Now this implied, eitz peri oseh peri, that not only would the trees bear fruit, not only would they be oseh peri, but they would be eitz peri. The wood would also taste like fruit. That's not what happened, though. The next verse teaches, Vatotzeor etz deshe esev mazriya zera l'minehu. Good change. God is happy. Ve'eitz oseh peri. But only fruit-bearing trees. The trees, the wood, did not taste like fruit. Bad. God is not happy. So, if you go back to the top of page 4 in your sources, it was to be that the fruit is eaten, so too the tree is eaten. She did not do so. The earth did not do this. But rather, the earth put forth grass, etc. The etc. is what's important. The fruit was edible, but the tree was not edible. So at the same moment, in the same verse, that the herbage, the grasses, took the initiative to improve themselves, the trees took steps to protect themselves. The trees concluded, I'll give you the simple explanation, straightforward. The trees concluded that were they to follow God's instructions, that the wood would be edible, they would be consumed by man along with the fruits. That wouldn't do well for survival. Nevertheless, although the trees acted out of a desire for self-preservation, God was displeased with this development. The unpredictable developments of life open the doorway to evil. The earth, which put forth the independent-minded trees and grasses, is also implicated in humanity's sin and is therefore cursed along with man and woman after the Eitz Hadas. However, this very unpredictability is essential to life on earth, and man's place in the world depends on it. A predictable world that develops from a scripted set of instructions is nothing more than a stage upon which life performs a contrived drama, an intelligently designed story enacted by state-of-the-art marionettes. There is no way to possess such a world, to make it your own, because you are never more than a puppet in an impersonal and passionless play in which you are both participant and audience.
That's the closing sentence.
What?
The closing sentence is Vayara lo kim ki tov. So he approved that change.
You mean in of the trees? Vayara lo kim. First of all, I should not be answering your question. But second of all, no, the reason I'll answer is because the answer is too complicated. Seriously. To explain the wording in Maisa Bereishis and the creation narrative, all of the wording is way beyond the scope of this. But to say it in half a sentence, the creation narrative is an historical statement, not merely a statement of that which occurred at the time. But it's complicated. I don't want to get into it. Now here's another, I think, remarkable insight. It is for these reasons that God expresses the creation of man, and only man, as a question. Chazal teach, source 8, Basora Mamoros Nivra Olam, with 10 utterances, the world was created. A mamar, an utterance, is a definitive, declarative sentence. One of the 10 mamoros, one of them is, source 9, Vayomer Elokim, Naase Odom Bitsalmenu Kidmusein. And God said, let's read the translation, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Yet, this translation is quite misleading. It's the standard translation. It's the translation almost anyone would give if they were asked to translate it. But, quite remarkably, Chazal understand the ma'amar of Na'ase Adam as a question. Source 10. In English, Rav Yehuda says that Rav says, at the time that the Holy One, blessed be He, sought to create a person, He created one group of ministering angels. He said to them, if you agree, let us fashion a person in our image. The angel said before him, Master of the universe, what are the actions of this person you suggest to create? God said to them, his actions are such and such, not particularly good, according to human nature. The angel said before him, Master of the universe, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you think of him, i.e., a creature such as this is not worth creating. What did God say? Well, I did ask for your advice, but nevertheless, God outstretched his small finger among them and burned them with fire. And the same occurred with a second group of angels. The third group of angels that he asked said before him, Master of the universe, the first two groups who spoke their mind before you, they didn't do too well. Oh, the entire world is yours. Whatever you wish to do in your world, do. God then created the first person. Chazal understand Na'ase Adam as a question. God asks, should we make man. And the angel's response was, Moenosh kisis karenu, what is man that you should be mindful of? I spoke about this last year. God's question is considered one of the Asora Mamoros, one of the ten primal statements of creation. It defines the creation of man. And the definition of man is that God will not determine what he is going to do. It's an open question. How can God issue a definitive ma'amar, such as Yihi Adam, let there be man? Yihi Or, just like let there be light. Yihi Adam, let there be man. When the entire point of man is that he must create himself. His creation must remain an open question. It is quite true that a ma'amar of creation must be ultimately definitive. And Na'aseh Adam is definitive. It definitively leaves the matter open-ended. Ultimately, Na'aseh Adam is a ma'amar. Let us make man. It is not a question of whether to create man, but rather a statement that the creation of man is itself a question. How could there be questions in creation? This question requires an answer that will be provided by creation and not an answer that is provided by God. Remember the insight of the Talmud based on the verse we just saw a few minutes ago, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, let God rejoice in his creations? This meant that the nature of a developing, self-organizing world is the only source of God's joy. The discovery of oneself in creation is the joy that God has in creation. There is no simcha when there is a direct response to God's instructions. Therefore, the Mishnah that we saw earlier asks, why in fact were there Asara Ma'amoros when one would have sufficed? One ma'amor would have been enough. Not only would it have been enough, more importantly, it would have been better. Because there would have been one instruction, and then God's out of it. It's up to you now. See what happens. So the Mishnah's answer suggests that in terms of creation itself, Asara Ma'amoros are a compromise. One ma'amar, Yihi Or, let there be light, would have sufficed. And that one ma'amar would have been ideal, because light contains the potential for all the rest. The fewer instructions that are given, the greater the opportunity for us to reveal Yichud Hashem, the oneness of God. The oneness and the unity, the complete integration of God. The more instructions that are given, the greater is the similarity to angels, whose very name, Malach, means one who follows instructions. The fewer instructions there are, the more all of creation resembles man, who is in essence an open question. Humanity is utterly unique. Humanity creates itself. Humanity is self-generated. With the words Na'aseh Adam, God declares, I can't tell you about man. Man is an open question. Man is the ultimate extension of a creation that must discover itself and self-organize. The added value of man in creation results from the fact that his creation is a question. Man presents answers. It is as if God says to man, you tell me what creation is about, because I don't know. That sounds terrible, right? But the Gemara says, it's an open Gemara, Libo Lepuma Lo Galya, God does not reveal his heart to his own mouth. it's hidden. As far as I'm concerned, God says, could be anything. After the creation of the first man, history awaited the arrival of another man who would breathe life into humanity by embodying all these ideas. That man was Avraham Avinu, the first freedom fighter. Well, I'm at that crucial point again. This is, you know, this is the beta version of this lecture series. I've never given this before. This is entirely new. So I never practiced it, so I never know. I don't know how long it's going to take. This shiur was actually shorter in pages than last week's, and in sources, but it's going slower. Well, What should I do? Should I stop? How entranced are you? What?
It's time for a break.
I appreciate the honesty. Okay. This kind of throws me off, but maybe we'll. I did start pretty much on time today, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Yes. So it's an hour. It's an hour. Yes. I will. I'm sorry to end so abruptly, but I literally am only at the halfway point. The second half might go faster than the first half, but I don't want to take that chance. So I'll get. This is a good point to stop. We'll proceed next week with Avraham Avinu, and if you're interested, maybe we'll schedule a fourth one in February or something, so I can do the last lecture, which is on tefillah. It's very important. But yes. Have a wonderful week. Oh, does anybody want the book? I have a box here. I can't carry it anywhere.
Yeah, the shill.
What?
The shill.
The shill.
If we take away the
responsibility,
the source is up.
I should thank the driver.
Sorry, I didn't know the rules.
Should have driven.